welcome to all. Yet another new operating system. At Nightingale, we'll Microsoft Research. We'll talk about satellite kernels with EBS. I believe Ed is also hiring. Are you hiring as well?
I think we're always hiring.
Yeah. They're always hiring.
We saw yesterday as well. Once upon a time, the world was a bit simpler. We had a RAM and a CPU, and things have been getting more complicated over the years in terms of the hardware that we've had to deal with. We've gone to SMP, and our CPUs recently have been dividing a little bit, and we've been getting CMPs. And as we're moving forward, we're getting towards an architecture like NUMA, where CPUs have local RAM and remote RAM, and you have heterogeneity in terms of performance. But fundamentally, this hardware inside of machines is homogeneous. All these CPUs are treated as interchangeable parts by the operating system. Unfortunately, today hardware is no longer homogeneous. We have things like programmable NICs and programmable GPUs that are available for programmers to write arbitrary code and take advantage of special functionality of these devices. And the question is, how have modern operating systems handled this heterogeneity that is available to us today? And the answer is that operating systems fundamentally ignore heterogeneity. And they ignore it for a couple reasons. One is that these programmable devices have different instruction sets than the operating systems running on. And they're also not cache coherent generally with the main CPUs. But programmers want to use these devices, and since the operating system is ignoring these devices, you end up missing all the standard operating system abstractions that we've had for the last three decades. And since programmers want to make use of these abstractions, we end up getting programming models that are fragmented because different devices have custom one-off runtimes to make these devices usable to programmers. Now, so the question is, can we bring this aspect of heterogeneity back in the fold of the operating system and provide a model for programmers to reason about this distributed system in this mode? And today what I'm going to talk about is Helios, which has been designed for this distributed system in this mode. Its goal is to simplify the process of developing, deploying, and tuning applications on heterogeneous platforms. And so we're trying to provide a single programming model for these heterogeneous programming devices. And today I'm going to talk to you about four different techniques that we use to manage heterogeneity. The first technique is a satellite kernel. Satellite kernels are identical operating system pieces of code that run every available programmable device and export the same operating system abstraction everywhere. And so this is going to go towards our first goal of easing the process of application development. Next, I'm going to talk to you about remote message passing. These satellite kernels are microkernels. Remote message passing allows processes to continue to communicate via IPC even if they're on separate kernels that have no cache coherence between them without having to be modified. Then I'm going to talk to you about affinity. Affinity is a mechanism provided by Helios that allows a programmer to express policies about what requirements processes have in terms of performance, in terms of resource requirements, so we can make good decisions about where we place a process when it's executed, even if the topology of the machine isn't necessarily known ahead of time. Finally, I'm just going to talk about our technique for contending with these different types of ISAs in our system by using a two-phase compilation strategy. And so, as a result, what I'm going to show you is that we're going to be able to take processes, operating system components, and applications that were never written with heterogeneity in mind or programmable devices in mind, we're going to offload them to programmable devices without changing any of the code inside them. We're also going to look at new architectures and show that we can improve the performance of applications on top of NUMA by eliminating a lot of the resource retention by running multiple kernels and eliminating the problems of remote memory accesses by making memory accesses that are remote explicit. So now I'll give you a little bit of the motivation. I'm going to take you through each of these four pieces of Helios in turn to tell you about how they work, and I'll give you an evaluation and we'll conclude. So why do we need satellite kernels? Well, here's our traditional computer. We're running a kernel and some applications, and you've got some sort of I/O device that you want to make use of. So you run a driver, and the driver does a great job of shoving bits over a bus to have the I/O device do something for you. But what happens when this device becomes a programmable device? It allows application programmers to start to run code and then take advantage of these devices. Well, since the operating system is fundamentally ignoring these devices, it falls upon the people who write the drivers to try and implement all the services that are required for a programmer to run their application. And so you end up with drivers mimicking a lot of these services that are in kernels. And to give a concrete example, the NVIDIA graphics drivers for Windows support for one single chipset is about 20 million lines of code, and it includes a JIT compiler. So you have an entire end-to-end tool set that's been stomped into a driver interface whose only function was to shove bits over a bus. It wasn't meant as an interface for programmability. And this means that it becomes really hard to perform basic tasks. Maybe if you try to debug CUDA, it's hard. If you want it to perform I/O to other devices located on a general purpose processor, it's difficult. If you want to do IPC, there's no standard way of doing it with other processes. And so you've got this driver doubling as an operating system inside an operating system. So the approach we're taking with Helios is to look at this programmable device, and we should run a kernel on it. And this is where we're running satellite kernels on these programmable devices. And so the goal of the satellite kernels are twofold. First of all, it's going to efficiently manage the resources on this device by running on it rather than acting as a proxy through a device driver. And secondly, it's going to provide a consistent set of abstractions for developers to program against when they develop applications. And so these satellite kernels are fundamentally microkernels. They're a thin layer that basically just includes a scheduler, a memory manager, and a namespace manager, to get into in a second, plus some GUI for handling IPC. As mentioned earlier, we're also going to look at NUMA machines, and we're going to treat them as shared nothing multiprocessors, and we're going to run satellite kernels on them as well, so that we can get performance isolation and avoid resource contention from the kernels. So if we're running these satellite kernels, the next question is, how do applications communicate with one another? Because each satellite kernel has a private address space. Well, since we're running in microkernels, all these applications have been written to use message passing. And so in our system, if your two applications are running on the same satellite kernel, then they're going to be using a fast zero-copy message passing that's local. However, if two applications end up running on different kernels, then the kernels cooperate with one another to automatically marshal messages between the two kernels to make this IPC transparent. So applications can continue to function even though they're running on separate devices. And this allows these applications to run unmodified. Well, now that we have these applications running on disjoint satellite kernels, even though they're communicating, we have to have a way for them to find one another. So we're running a namespace, similar spirit to the Plan 9 operating system. And this namespace lists all the operating system components and processes that are available to connect via message passing. And so you can see there are different devices, networking stacks, and any arbitrary application can advertise itself in namespace. And once an application connects to it, makes a request to namespace to connect to a process, Helios determines where that process is located. If it's located locally, we use a local message passing channel. If it's located remotely, we use a remote message passing channel. You notice that kernels are also advertised in this namespace. The reason the kernel is advertised in the namespace is that its channel is used to launch processes on that programmable device. And it also doubles because it describes the type of processor that it's on, as describes it with its capabilities. We'll get into a moment for why it does that. So, if you have this namespace and you have this topology of applications, it becomes important to determine where a process should execute it when you first launch it. And there are three constraints that make this decision especially important. First one is that we're dealing with heterogeneous instruction sets, which means migration between these devices is difficult. And so you want to make a good decision the first time when you launch an application. The second is that two processes might be expecting fast message passing on the same kernel. Now, they end up on two different kernels, and the performance can really suffer because remote message passing involves copying data. Finally, you might have a process that prefers one type of platform over another. And so a process might want to make sure that if a certain programmable device is available, then it's going to be able to run on top of it. So to handle these constraints, Helios introduces an affinity metric. And this mechanism is expressed in the application metadata and acts as a hint to Helios about where this process should run. And so it's very simple. It's expressed over communication channels, which represent the dependencies of the process when it's launched. Positive affinity represents an emphasis on communication. It means it wants zero copy in a process communication. And a negative affinity represents a desire for non-interference. For example, it's a way of avoiding resource contention between two processes they execute. So I just want to first give an example of how affinity is expressed. This is an example of an application manifest that arrives with each process. I just want to call your attention, it's just plain XML. I want to call your attention to a couple different pieces here. This first line that's highlighted, the input pipe ID0 is standard in, and this process has no preference to where it executes in relation to the standard in process, because its affinity value is 0, which is the default. The second value is the TCP contract, which is actually the TCP networking stack. So it has an affinity value of 10, which means there's a strong preference to execute wherever the TCP stack happens to be executed. So as you can see, it's really easy for anyone to edit these manifests. If there's a new topology that was unexpected, or there are different performance characteristics, a user can edit the manifest and change the affinity values to change how these placement policies are executed. So I want to take you through a couple of different policies that you can create using this simple affinity metric. The first one is a platform affinity. As I mentioned earlier, these kernels advertise themselves in namespace, and they show their particular type of process they're executing on. And we expect that eventually these would be agreed upon standardized names that developers could count on. So in this case, we have a manifest that has been converted into the locations in the namespace and the affinities. This is what Helios would see. So the first preference is for a GPU, a vector processor. So Helios is going to find the satellite kernels where this is available, and it's just simply going to assign the affinity to it. Next, there's a preference for an x86 CPU. So it's going to assign each satellite kernel running these newer domains a positive affinity as well. So this platform affinity performs, it acts as a constraint and performs a certain set of guarantees for a limited amount of performance characteristics for the process. So in this case, the programmable NIC that was up there was not available for execution because it wasn't in the platform affinity. Now, platform affinity is optional. If there is no platform affinity, Helios is going to continue processing the other affinity values to make a decision on where to execute the process. So in general, positive affinity represents a tight coupling between two processes. It's a preference for fast message passes between two entities that are going to execute. And so the way positive affinities are executed in general is that Helios goes, and for each service for which there's a positive affinity preference, it finds a service and then simply puts the affinity value on that kernel. And then as it goes through, finds each service, adds the affinity value, sums them, and finds the kernel with the highest positive affinity value and chooses that kernel to execute the application. So now I also mentioned that there's negative affinity, which is a preference for non-interference, which then might have two CPU-intensive applications that don't want to interfere with one another. You might have an application that doesn't want to be interrupted by the interrupts that are generated by a networking card or disk. So in this case, we have an application that has a strong preference for an x86 processor with platform affinity. And then it has a negative preference for the antivirus service that's executing. So Helios finds where this service is executing, finds the kernel, assigns it the negative affinity value, and then it takes the kernel with the highest affinity value, which is the remaining kernel in the system. So this is a simple way for processes to avoid other processes in the system that they don't want to be coalesced within the same kernel. And a specific version of type of policy you can develop with negative affinity is something called self-reference affinity. And so processes that tend to scale out from embarrassingly parallel can simply reference themselves so that they scale out across available computation resources. So in this case, we have a web server that has a negative affinity of 1 with itself. The first time it executes, Helios isn't going to do anything because there's no existing web servers. But the second time, it's going to find that it's executing in one kernel, assign a negative affinity, and launch it somewhere else where it's not yet running. And it'll continue to do this as many times as the server is launched. So this is a simple way to express an interesting policy with a very simple mechanism. So just to give you an idea of how we process affinities, we have a priority-based algorithm. So we first process platform affinities. This gives us a set of constraints about which kernels are available to us. Then we process the other positive affinities. We process these negative affinity values, or non-interference affinities. And finally, if there are multiple kernels left over, we break ties to CPU. Now, affinity is pretty simple. It's just a basically an ordered list. And this is our attempt to balance simplicity with optimality. We want something that was very expressive, but we wouldn't want something that was so overly complicated that people wouldn't use it. And we found in our own use that it's been pretty useful for expressing different policies with the applications we've developed. So the last thing I mentioned is that we're going to handle the problem of how these different instruction sets are available to us. And so the way we do this is with a two-phase compilation strategy. All the applications are first compiled down to MSIL, And at install time, the compiler that's available will compile the MSAL down to each available instruction set of the system. Now, MSAL is convenient. It's an intermediate representation because it can encapsulate multiple versions of a method if those methods have been specialized for a particular architecture. So, for example, in our system, we support ARMx86 right now. We have an analog compare exchange instruction that uses assembly language features. And so both those versions ship in the MSAL binary, and each is compiled down to the appropriate architecture to install. Imagine the same thing, let's say, with a vector math library. So we built Helios by forking the Singularity operating system and adding support for satellite kernels, remote message passing, and Fifi. And right now we support two different platforms. We support an X-scale programmable I/O card as a 2 GHz ARM processor and a gigabit Ethernet port. And the satellite kernel that runs in the ARM card is exactly identical to the satellite kernel that runs on the x86 processors, modulo the assembly language GUI that we add onto the pop-up. So the satellite kernel, this X-scale programmable I/O card, runs about 7 times slower than a comparable x86. The second platform we support are these new architectures, and so we have a 2 new domain and the machine that we run satellite kernels on as well. Now, I want to bring up the limitations of the system since it's a prototype that we're learning a lot from. So satellite kernels require 3 hardware primitives to execute. They require a timer, interrupt controller, and the ability to handle exceptions or traffic. And so this is our attempt to balance being able to service, have local services like scheduling, while not requiring too many hardware primitives that we couldn't support low-end devices. Now you notice that there isn't an MMU up here. That's because we're basing ourselves on Singularity, which is uses software-isolated processes. If you built this on top of Mach, you'd also have to add an MMU probably to that list. And so, you'll notice also that we don't support 2 platforms. We don't support a graphics card yet, which is one of the most interesting uses of this. GPUs currently don't have timers on them, although future GPUs that are coming, such as Intel's Larrabee and some other graphics card programmers, are adding this functionality as they're building new GPUs because they're realizing this is being used more and more for interesting arbitrary code. Also, since this is a research project, we have limits of applications. And so if we looked again to create a commodity operating system like Mach or like Linux, then we'd have more applications to play with. So now I just want to talk about the evaluation. And what we're trying to understand is, does Helios make it easier to reason about and program these devices that we have in our system? And in the evaluation, I'm going to be talking about 2 different platforms. The first is our X-scale programmable device. When I talk about the evaluation for this device, on the left-hand side, I'm going to be talking about a standard Helios kernel with a non-programmable card, just a PCI NIC. And then we'll be comparing that to a version where we run the X-scale programmable device, we run 2 satellite kernels, and the NIC is on the device itself. When I talk about new evaluations, I'm going to be talking about either running a single kernel, similar to what you do with a monolithic kernel, across both new domains, and I'm going to be talking about running satellite kernels in each individual domain in parallel. So the first thing we did is we took a whole slew of applications that were not written for Helios. These were applications that had been written during the building of Singularity, and we offloaded them to the programmable device. And so you can see, for example, there's a FAT32 file system. We offloaded this file system to the X-scale card without changing any of its source code, just by changing one line of its metadata to express an affinity preference with the card itself. And so all the other applications that were executing the X86 continued to function because of remote message passing, and any applications that have a preference to be close to the file system will pull along with it over to the X-scale card. You notice here we have a networking driver, and you notice that no code and no metadata was changed. This is kind of fun. The X-scale programmable card has the same NIC chipset on it that Singularity had already supported in the form of a PCI card. And so we booted the satellite kernel on the programmable device. It recognized the chipset. It asked for the ARM version driver, pulled it over, and just ran it. So in this case, with the drivers that are running as processes in the system, they will run without changing any source code. The last time I noticed this TCP test harness, in this case, we did change some code. It was because our satellite kernel didn't yet have all the floating point emulation code inside it. And so we had to remove that code when we initially ran the system. Our satellite kernel does support that now. And it just tells us that your satellite kernel really needs to have all the functionality available required for the applications to be able to run them and get this transparent movement from between different devices. This tells us that the abstractions we built for those have done a pretty reasonable job allowing us to take advantage of these different devices. So next thing we did was just decided to take the net stack and just offload an entire networking stack to the card and see if we could do something useful with it. And so we used Affinity to offload the card and or offload the networking stack. And we had an application on the left-hand side here that decompresses PNG images that are sent to the network. And the left column shows you the size of the PNG image, which tells you how CPU intensive it was to decompress. The second column gives you the uploads per second that the system could handle when, without using a programmable device. And the third column gives you the improved uploads per second by adding the programmable device and offloading the stack. The fourth column is the speed up. And the speed up is proportional to the number of CPU cycles that were basically freed up by moving the networking stack from the x86 to the programmable device. You notice in the last column is a large number reduction in the number of context switches that were taken by the PNG decompressing service. The reason for this is that when we moved the entire networking stack off into the card, that satellite kernel was absorbing all the interrupts from the NIC, which meant that the PNG service of the x86 processor wasn't seeing as much pollution as its cache and wasn't being interrupted all the time by the networking stack. So last, I just want to mention one other benchmark here, a slew of others in the paper. And so we looked at an email server that was built in Singularity. An email server is composed of three different processes. There's an SMTP server front end, there is a disk, a storage system on top of the file system, and then there's an antivirus agent that scans all the emails as they come into the system. In this case, we ran two different versions, as I mentioned earlier. One was just a single kernel spanning both human domains, the one with independent satellite kernels. And the antivirus agent expressed negative affinity with the SMTP server front end because it didn't want to be polluted with all the interrupts that were coming in during the test. And so as you can see, we're writing the antivirus agent in a separate human domain, even though we're paying the cost of copying messages between these two different satellite kernels, we've improved the performance about 39%. We're interested in getting a better understanding of why this was the case, so we flipped on the performance counters in the system. We can see that we got about a 20% improvement in our instruction throughput on the antivirus agent. The reason for this was that its iCache and its dcache weren't being polluted by other processes, by the kernel. It just wasn't being interrupted all the time in the network and by the disk. This gives a sense that the performance isolation provided by NUMA works pretty well. So I just want to mention a brief bit of related work. I want to mention Hive, which was one of the first systems to test remote kernels on a NUMA system in a single system image. And of course, yesterday we heard about the multi-kernel, which right now is focused on understanding and tuning performance heterogeneity on large-scale systems. Well, we're focused on figuring out how to incorporate heterogeneous instruction sets for programmable devices. And finally, there have been several other runtimes that were specifically meant for different chipsets that were written, such as Spine and Hydra. Well, we're taking a different approach, which is looking at general-purpose set of abstractions. So Helios was designed for our distributed system to small. I've talked about four different techniques that Helios uses to make it easier to develop, deploy, and tune applications for programming devices. Use satellite kernels, remote message passing, affinity, and two-phase compilation. Allows us to offload applications without having to change them for a new type of device. And so we're releasing the Helios code to the public as part of the Singularity RDK real soon now. So thank you.
Wire rather than your PCI bus.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and in the paper we
pay homage to that, the distributed operating systems. Okay. You know, you've gotten small, you don't have latency, it's not lossy, it's high performance, you don't need TCP. So we've taken taken those lessons and we've tried to apply them to a little distributed system and move forward.
I agree with that.
Okay, so the other thing that bridged up from that experience back then, which some of which I had personally, was that you start out thinking, well, once you have distributed microkernels, you can do remote execution one place and carefully. And our experience was that if you could just have a simple heuristic run it somewhere else, what you actually needed was that when you run it somewhere else, which is just, you know, you identify who's likely loaded and push it off there, the world changes, so you would like to have process migration. And at that point, once you have process migration, you can change your mind, so it's better to do something quickly. And so to me, relative to that experience, your whole affinity story in XML looks like JCL.
Well, I sure, but you know, process migration turned out to be pretty brittle, and turned out to be pretty difficult. And so one of the goals here was to, especially as you get GPUs at every 6 months or you new chipsets and new architecture, we're going to avoid the problems of process migration.
GPUs are wounded processors, and the reality is we've always had everything migrate to general purpose. And the work done in V, and there was other work where you migrated things, and you, in fact, could even migrate things between heterogeneous architectures. So you invest in the migration, and then without migration, you are committed to run something someplace or other. And the evil thing is that you commit to run something, it's a wrong, long-running thing, which ends up being a problem.
Sure. I see your point. I think, like I said, I think process migration, you know, we're seeing virtual machine migration, but we're not really seeing process migration these days. And that's because I think it was an abstraction that turned out to be pretty brittle with the opportunity of operating systems and the architectures that are being supported. So instead, went with the approach of trying to make a good decision initially. I see the trade-off we're talking about.
This is maybe an interesting. I have a second question. It seems that the Luna machine, the benefit of having software isolation kind of goes away because you're still copying memory and you're already kind of isolated. But on the other hand, you have this language runtime, which probably bigger inside a secure form microkernel. So do you think it's still reasonable to keep this model, or you should do something where you get rid of this runtime, provide hardware protection?
The system is not dependent on type safety. It was dependent on, we can't even engineer your language. The type safety, the safe message path to drive similarity isn't fundamental to the system. So, like I said, you can implement the system. MOCAT network proxies to allow you to connect basically both channels across the network. And so you could take a microkernel like that and put the safety in the system.
If there's no more questions, let's thank Ed again.